Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Orange Line is back. After a month-long shutdown, the Orange Line resumed service this morning, on track with the T's initial timeline. So, what did the T actually accomplish in that time, and was it worth it? Boston Mayor Michelle Wu seems to think so. Here she is earlier this morning after her commute.
We had a great ride in this morning on the new and improved Orange Line. It was fun to look at all the little improvements along the way, the stations that had been cleaned and brand new paint, new stairs installed, new lighting.
Joining us on the line with more, WBUR's Simone Rios. Hey, Simone.
Hey, Tiziana.
So I know you're joining us from North Station. How are things running there this morning?
It seems pretty smooth. I got on at Green Street Station and accompanied someone to North Station. Very smooth, I would say, so far. I'm only seeing the new cars. And as the mayor just said, they're pretty nice. Nice big wide doors. And, you know, they don't have those old upholstery seats any longer. So that's an upgrade.
Do they have new car smell?
Just a little bit, yeah.
All right, so remind us of the scope of the work that the T took on during this 30 days, Simone.
Let's go over some of the numbers. So the T says it installed 14,000 feet of rail, activated 72 new Orange Line cars, as you can hear go by me right now, ran 45,000 feet of new signal cable, replaced 2,800 rail ties, and installed 3,500 feet of track. You know, so to give you a little sense of the detail completed, I noticed that the yellow footing strips, you know, those lines along the edge of the platform.
The little bumpy ones.
A lot of that was replaced. It wasn't in very good condition before. Apparently, that's important for vision-impaired folks to know where to stand safely to wait for the train. But they also completed construction of an elevator at Forest Hills, and the station is now fully accessible at two key entrances. So that's just a sample of the kind of work that also happened at Sullivan Square and Oak Grove and other Orange Line stops.
That's really helpful, and I'll just flag, we'll have a conversation with the T writer tomorrow about accessibility on the commuter rail and the T. So that's a good look forward. Tell us what you're hearing from riders.
Yeah, so like I said, I got on at Green Street and rode with somebody to here at North Station. You know, it's almost like back to normal, like nothing ever happened except these new train cars. You know, the shutdown was obviously a major inconvenience to riders. But I think people are giving the T the benefit of the doubt that things will get better. One gentleman told me he's hoping that every day Orange Line service is as good as the best days prior to the shutdown. Another guy I talked to was Sam Walls. He works at a biotech company and lives in Roxbury. He says the shutdown added an hour and two connections to each way of his commute. Now he's waiting to see if things improve.
I mean, I was waiting just as long as the station as before, which I was hoping that like the frequency would go up of the trains, but it seems like it hasn't really changed. It's only been one day, though, so I guess we can't really tell there.
So at his first stop, like he got on and the first stop of the train was at Ruggles after that. There was some kind of interruption. It only lasted a couple of minutes. Folks were just sitting there. There was a beeping in the background. One passenger expressed frustration that the conductor didn't say why the train had stopped. But other than that, smooth sailing.
All right. So now we move to a Green Line shutdown. It's the D line between Riverside and Kenmore Square coming up. What can we expect from that, Simone?
Right. So the E-Line branch was also closed for a month. Now that's open, right? But there are major closures planned on the D branch. That's the one that runs from Union Square to out in Newton. So starting Saturday, there will be three 9-day closures. So 27 days of closure through October 30th. And then there's a few days that it will be open intermittently within that period. And the goal here is to carry out track improvements to improve safety. So the D line is the last Green Line branch to receive these upgrades, and there will be periodic closures on parts of the Red Line as well.
All right. WBUR Simone Rios, I know we'll continue to follow all of this as things go down, come up, go down, and come up. Thank you, Simone.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So Mella Bush-Miles is the director of transit-oriented development and at the T Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. Mella, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Great to have you here in Studio 2. First reactions to what we just heard from Simone and this first morning with the Orange Line back on track.
Well, I think the new car smell has to be much better than those old car smells that we were all so accustomed to. Our community of riders has been, you know, concerned about the startup. And some of the things that the MBTA did inform us of while it was shut down is that there will be a period of slowness while things settle in, because they just laid all of this new tracks and all of those things. So that's a settling period. But, you know, we're concerned about, like, making sure that the cars are safe, because Orange Line trains, even the new ones, had had a lot of issues going on. So, you know, the riders are concerned because of the history of the new Orange Line trains. They had to be pulled off on numerous occasions. And so that's a concern, and sustainability and being able to sustain this going forward as the service starts to speed back up. It'll be maybe a week or two, they said, before it comes back to its speed. So
those slow zones, right, on the Orange Line, where they're saying they need to let the tracks settle before they can bring the trains back to full speed. My understanding, Mella, is that those slow zones have been in place for about 3 years. So if that goes back to quote unquote normal, right, or a new normal, that could help a lot. I do wonder, sort of, as an advocate, is there some threshold and what does it look like, or how long out is it where you look back and say, okay, these repairs were successful? Not yes, we should have done it this way or not, but this was a successful undertaking.
When we see speed, reliability and sustainability and a feeling of safety, from a rider's perspective, the safety is really important to them. They need a safety MBTA. So that's what a major concern is, because we've had a history of unsafe conditions and people were really apprehensive. And myself as a rider, I have been apprehensive about a few things. But there are other things that are in the maintenance and repair schedule that need to be done still, aside from just the tracks and the trains. There's more safety issues that need to be addressed. So, you know, those are some of our concerns.
See. Yes. I want to play a little sound for you, Mella. And we're speaking with Mella Bush-Miles from the T Riders Union here in Studio 2. Here was Governor Baker. This is yesterday, talking with reporters at a press conference.
We all know that the last 30 days have been inconvenient and complicated for riders, and we appreciate their patience and their willingness to adapt, as the T did a ton of necessary work to accelerate infrastructure investments and service improvements across the system.
And the governor has reminded us that the work they did over those 30 days was the equivalent of 5 years of weekend work. And yet there was a really steep price to pay in terms of people's time and accessibility. Was this the right way to go?
In hindsight, I would say if you could get 5 years of work done in 30 days, if I could get 5 years of work done in 30 days.
You would do it?
I would do it, you know. So I think, you know, it could have been planned out a little further, because it was kind of a shock to the system and a shock to the people. And there were a lot of kinks that had to be worked out as it went forward, whether it was accessibility, seniors, language access, all of those things needed to be worked out. And so those were some of the things, the feedback that we got. And myself, having ridden from one end of the line to the other at the beginning, I saw a lot of challenges for seniors and them trying to figure out, you know, communicating better with the riders and do you have to pay here, do not have to pay there, things like that. Getting halfway to where you were going, then having to get on the green line, then pay to get on, then get on. You know, those kind of things. Those were very challenging for riders.
Did that get better as it went along over the 30 days?
A little, yeah.
A little.
It did. We were having meetings with the MBTA on Fridays as advocates, some of us, and we were giving them that information, and they did work to address, especially some of the language barriers. and the signage communicating to people, you know, and also the issue of like Government Center. You know, someone would want to go to Haymarket and they had to get off the bus and then go downstairs. They had to get off of the Green Line and then walk down a lot of stairs and walk around. And then to get back, they had to do that in reverse.
Do it again.
So there were seniors. We followed one gentleman who said, I have arthritis. Going down these stairs is a nightmare. And then I have to try and get back up those stairs.
Whereas so, they would have been all underground before.
Right. He would have got off at Haymarket, got in the escalator,
right,
and went to his destination, which right, he could not do that. Plus, Government Center was closed down, the plaza.
So, Mel, it strikes me that you were having these regular meetings with the governor on Fridays.
Excuse me, the tea.
We talked
no,
about the governor,
the tea,
on Fridays. Should that continue once this maintenance work is done? Would you like that kind of regular opportunity to provide feedback?
Yes.
Pure and simple. Okay, and what are you watching for as we look at the next shutdowns? We know that there will be shutdowns, as we just talked about with Simone Rios. What's most important to you?
More communication, better communication with the public, better coordination with the teams. And there's also a commuter rail shutdown from the 17th to the 27th on the Newburyport-Rockport line that's happening coming into North Station. Chelsea riders and people up the up the line there, Lynn, Chelsea, that's going to impact them. So better communication and really accommodating people a little better and really listening to our feedback and making sure that all of these things that we suggest would be implemented.
All right. Mella Bush-Miles is Director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. Mella, I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All this week, we will be bringing you stories from local artists of color as part of the WBUR series, The Makers. Today, we bring you one of a Somerville photographer, Iaritza Menjivar. Her images have appeared in national papers like The Washington Post, and she has snapped photos of politicians like Joe Kennedy, Deval Patrick. But her most consistent subject has been her family. WBUR's Amelia Mason has more on this photographer and her series called First Generation.
Iaritza Menjivar's family immigrated to the States from El Salvador and Guatemala before she was born. Her parents, aunts, and uncles all raised families while working long hours for little pay.
Sometimes my aunt would be in the kitchen right straight out of work, and I would take these images of her at the table, like, feeling all tired, and she'd be like, why? Like, stop. Like, I just got out of work. I'm tired. And I'd be like, I know, but this is what I want. Like, I want these natural moments, these honest moments of you coming back from a 14-hour day at a factory, extremely tired, and you're still cooking dinner for your husband. Like, this is the kind of image I want to make.
The images she ended up making were compelling enough to be featured in the New York Times Lens blog. One photograph centers on Menjivar's younger brother, Hugo. The teen stands just outside the door to the living room in his father's house. He looks down at his phone, his face lit up by the screen.
From the hallway perspective, you can also see into the living room where my family is congregated and they're just having a conversation.
Menjivar points out a framed picture on the wall behind Hugo that says hope. It could represent her parents' hope for a better future, she says. Or it could represent their children's yearning for a life of their own.
It's like a bittersweet feeling, right? Because we want to be there to support them, but we also have this life that we want to create for ourselves and be independent. And
in Menjivar's photograph, these twin hopes live in different worlds, side by side. The image is literally divided in two. On one side, the family clustered in a circle. On the other, Hugo, in a rare moment alone.
Living with our family, there isn't a lot of solitude. There's always a lot of people around.
These days, Menjivar is seeking more solitude. She realized she needed to tend less to her family and more to her own needs. So, she says, she's embarking on a new photography project with a new subject, herself.
That's WBUR's Amelia Mason, and photographer Iaritza Menjivar joins us here in studio to talk more about her work. Iaritza, welcome.
Thank you.
How does it feel to hear that story, to hear other people being told about you in that way?
Well, I got a little teary-eyed right now. It's just like the beginning of it, me talking about my family immigrating here and knowing that I'm here in live radio talking about that experience is very powerful. And it's a very vulnerable situation as well for me and my family, but it's necessary in our times. So,
your family, your first generation family from El Salvador and Guatemala.
Yes.
What feels most vulnerable now? Talk about that.
Being put on the spot, you know, like they immigrated here to have stability, to have a better life for themselves, to be able to provide to our family who are still living in their countries, including my grandparents, who at the time are not doing well with their health. So being the project puts them on a spotlight, but also talking about like other people's issues, because it's this is my family, but it's also a community that I'm trying to bring to the light and talk about how immigration is a huge issue in our country.
These are deeply intimate and personal pictures. The descriptions that Amelie made of Hugo are perfect. And then there's a fantastic one of a child jumping on a bed and a mother doing that thing we all do, right, where you're kind of holding your head like you're exhausted. And then an amazing picture, a multi-generational picture of one person blow-drying their hair on one side of a bathroom door right by the kitchen and another older member of the family sitting tired and still in the kitchen. These are really intimate moments, and yet they capture so much that could be anyone's story. How do you do that? How do you recognize in a moment this will tell a whole story?
At the moment, what I concentrate in is being able to take those honest moments, and they speak for themselves, in my opinion. And especially in that photo that you talk about, my aunt being extremely tired. Like, she works 12, 13, 14-hour days every single day of her life. And just her expression, her clothes, like, the kitchen being a little messy because there's no time to clean up the mess, it just shows the sacrifices that they're doing so that my cousins and I can have a better life. And my hope is that other people are able to connect that with their own experiences.
We're talking to one of the artists in the WBUR Maker Series, Iaritza Menjivar, who's a Somerville photographer with a new series called First Generation. And I want to bring two other voices into this conversation now as well, because sitting here also with us in Studio 2, two of the WBUR arts reporters working on this story, we have Amelia Mason, who gave us that packaged story about Iaritza. Welcome, Amelia.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And Cristela Guerra, who we often know on Fridays from our prep for the weekends. Cristela, good to have you here.
It's always an honor to be here.
So, Amelia, let's start with you. So you've shared Iaritza's work. Now we're hearing Iaritza talk about it. Why is it so important to invite the region into these intimate spaces?
I mean, you know, I think Iaritza gestured to it, of course, the political implications, obviously, of what it means to be a first-generation American, have parents who immigrated here and work really hard and make a lot of sacrifices. I think that is the subtext, maybe the not such a subtext of her work. But what I love about it is that it doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel sort of polemical, I guess, maybe. It just feels very intimate and beautiful. It's important, but it's also just great photography.
Cristela, you were nodding a lot while Iaritza was talking with us. So what was some of that that was resonating with you?
I mean, I was born in Panama, and I know those, like, I know that journey, you know, just common empathy and understanding of that world, and especially when your family can gather together, which most of my family, the big part of my family is still in Panama. So I just was really touched. And I don't know, I just think it's really, to your point, I think considering in light of the current political climate, it's an important thing for people to see, if just for people to understand universal truths of family and relationship. And I don't know, I personally don't think I have to explain to people why my family deserves to be in this country, you know, but I also think that often people don't get to see into homes of all kinds of people from all kinds of different places. I think that they're fed a certain diatribe about immigrants, and they're dehumanized.
So with that in mind, Iaritza, I'll turn back to you, because we've talked again about how intimate your photographs are, how personal. How did photography become a part of you, if that's a reasonable way to frame it?
Photography, I've always been a very reserved, kind of quiet person, and I think that through photography, I found another language where I could express myself without having to say words and put myself out there, what I thought. But through photography, I've always been an observant, so being able to have a tool to show what I've been observing, I think that's really, it's just a different way to express myself.
So in preparing for this and looking at your photographs, of course, part of what was unfolding was the nearly 50 South American migrants who were essentially tricked into getting on a plane in San Antonio, coming to Martha's Vineyard. Now they're at Joint Base Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. How has that spoken to you or resonated with you? And if you could use your photography with them, what would you want to capture?
Yes. So actually, I read about this on Thursday afternoon right before going to this museum exhibit called Sanctuary City. So speaking about sanctuary towns and cities and places, and it really shocked me. And just knowing how these people are coming here with a purpose, you know, seeking asylum, and then they're just put in an even worse situation that they've already been through their journey. And I don't know, I wish that they can see that there is some kind of hope and that that their story right now is also being put on the light, and that at least in a way they will be making history, and that it hopefully will be on the road for some change.
And just to underscore just a piece of your point there, you talked about the Sanctuary City exhibit. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has claimed responsibility for this flight, has said it was to relocate people to sanctuary cities. So that sits in the middle of this. Yes. I want to take a step back now. We still have also with us Chris de la Guerra and Amelia Mason, and I want to talk about this series, which we're launching. You had the fantastic motorcycle artist this morning on Morning Edition. I really also thoroughly enjoyed that. and I want to talk a little bit about the series itself. So Cristela, the goal of the series, tell us a little bit about it.
I mean, I think, you know, when you consider it, it's to uplift. It's to celebrate, it's to educate an artist in our communities all across the region. It's called The Makers because they make community, right? They make photographs, they make woodwork, they do all kinds of things that I think in a moment, again, I always feel like art is a balm, and it's also a solution, it's an answer. It's an opportunity, I think, for us as an arts and culture team to give people something different to look at that they may never, ever see. Maybe something that motivates them in their own artwork and their own process. I think it also offers some healing, you know, because it delves into so many aspects, culture, race, identity. I think our project does all of that.
Amelia, Cristela is talking about some very powerful forces there. As you go out and meet these amazing artists and you're putting together these profiles, learning their work, how do you approach that? And I'm just going to ask you straight up, is it as fun and cool as it looks like it is to get to meet these makers?
Yeah, I mean, it is really fun. I think it can be a real mixture of things. You get to discover what people who are starting, sort of coming up in their career, like you see where they work, which is often at home. You know, this is not a series on people who are super, super established. They're people who are in that moment journeying, you know, in that direction. I think it's also very vulnerable. It's often like the first big profile that some of these artists have had. And so you have to be very careful with their stories. I think there's also an element when you're covering, so it's a series on artists of color. And so identity comes in. And I think you have to be very careful, to try not to tokenize people, stereotype them, or overly focus on their... maybe their biography, because what it should be about is the work. Very often the work deals with their biography and their personal life. Yeah. But, you know, that is a fine line to tread, too.
And Yaritza, turning back to you, Yaritza Menjivar here in Studio 2 is a Somerville photographer with a new series called First Generation, who is one of the 15 makers in this third year of the Maker Series at WBUR. Do you feel you have come into a new community being a part of these 15 artists?
Yes, definitely. It's been incredible just today in the morning to look through who are the other artists involved and reading about all the amazing work that everyone's creating. And I'm really excited to meet everyone on Thursday as well and hopefully create this new community, right, that I can look out for, and we can collaborate and do things together as well and grow together.
So, Cristela, tell us what we mean when we say meet everyone on Thursday.
Oh, we have a party on Thursday. We have a big, big event. Starts at 7:30, but doors open at 7 o'clock. Tickets are free. They can come to City Space at WBUR, and they can see some of these incredible members of our cohort perform. And honestly, we can just enjoy each other's company, I think, and appreciate the different mediums in the room. It's a first, I think, of many opportunities that we try and give them to just meet and mingle. And I think to Amelia's point, there are people emerging, but there's also people who've been doing the work who are finally getting their moment in the sun.
So why, yeah. Amelia Mason, is it so important? You made reference to the fact that we are featuring artists at a moment in their career as they're coming up. Why is it important to catch that now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes for me so much to like what it means to be in Boston and to care about the arts here. You know, we're not New York City, we're not LA, but there's stuff happening here that may not be visible to people who maybe don't, you know, aren't super inside, right? And so I hope that it sort of, you know, creates pride for people in their city, in the region, and say like, look, we're producing talent. Like, this is happening here. People are doing it, and it's original, and it's going somewhere. It's saying something.
And Iarissa, what do you hope comes out of this for you?
I feel like sometimes being an artist feels very lonely. You know, you're working in your studio a lot. You're working on your work a lot. And then being able to come into a community like this, there's companionship. There is other people who are going through the same things as you are. And I feel like the collaborations, I feel what you're mentioning, Amelia, just feeling really proud to be here and to be making this work.
So I want to look ahead now a little bit to some of the other people who are going to be there on Thursday night at WBUR City Space, and that our listeners will hear throughout the week this week. So, Cristela, on Thursday, we'll hear your reporting on Yvette Modestin. So give us a sneak peek on that.
Yvette, I've been a journalist for almost 20 years. Yvette is the first Panamanian that I've had the opportunity as a Panamanian to write about. And that, to me, is so important and special, considering that we were in the same country and born of the same homeland and place. She's a poet. She does work around anti-racist workshops to help specifically people from Latin America understand the diversity of the African diaspora in Latin America in their specific area. So Black folks that were brought specifically enslaved to Panama who have been there for centuries, who established societies based on their former countries, you know. And honestly, the way that that culture, lineage, and customs roots itself in each country differently versus Guatemala, Peru, Colombia, there's Afro-Caribbean people. And so her work is to make people love their Blackness and truly understand that instead of the erasure that we often see, that you must embrace all parts of who you are.
And we'll meet her Thursday.
Yeah.
And Amelia, tell us what else we can look forward to this week.
Oh, man, so much. I love how, like, sort of the wide range of kind of practice that people have in this series. You know, we heard Andrea Shays feature earlier about someone who designs motorcycles. So we've got a pole dancer, you know, we've got people who kind of work in the urban planning space with public art, you know, we've got dancers, we have a drag performer. So it's very, very kind of wide ranging in that sense.
And Iarissa, we opened with you here in the studio. We'll close with you here in the studio. What's most important to you to know that there are new people seeing your work? Do you understand my question? What does that mean for you that so many new people will see your work?
I think what I would love for people to understand about the work is that it is about a family, and there are a lot of struggles, and immigration comes up a lot, but the work grew out of love. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of support with each other, with one another in our community, and I want people to also appreciate that part of this project.
All right. That is Somerville photographer Iarissa Menjivar with a new series, First Generation, one of the 15 makers from WBUR's Maker Series. Here in studio, also WBUR's Cristela Guerra and Amelia Mason, both arts reporters working on the series. Thanks to all of you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We got a little something to cheer about yesterday.
Handoff, steamrolling, Damian Harris, touchdown, Patriots.
That's what I'm talking about. All right, all right.
Jonathan, are you there too?
I'm here. It's a glorious Monday, right?
Jonathan Marshall on the line, reporter for WMUR, and in, here in Studio 2, WBUR's Chris Siderick. We're going to talk about sports. The Pats got their first win of the year, beating the Steelers 17-14 yesterday. They're now 1-1 in the season. But I want to note, somehow winning this one felt more important than those numbers suggested. And Jonathan, I'm not entirely sure it felt like a win.
Hey, a win is a win, right?
That's right. That's right. You tell her.
You only get so few games in the NFL season, right? It's not like baseball or the NBA, so you have to get these wins, right, when you get the opportunity to. And the good teams beat the teams that they're supposed to beat. And New England should have beaten this Pittsburgh Steelers squad.
Yeah, and you're not the only one that feels that way either, Tiziana. I don't know if you saw right after the game, Bill Belichick ran over and hugged Mac Jones with about as much enthusiasm as I've seen him shown in 20 years. So it clearly mattered to the team, too, and to Coach Belichick.
And, Jonathan, why did it seem like such an important win this week? It's the second game of the season. I understand shorter season, but there were a couple of other things at stake, too, that you guys sneak previewed for us last Monday.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think what stood out to me in this game was I think we're getting a sneak peek at how this team is going to have to win, and it's going to be ugly. It was rough early on offensively, but I think that final drive sort of showed the identity. You know, this team has been searching for an identity offensively, and I think that final drive, giving it to Damian Harris, getting those tough yards to run down the clock to close out the W, that's how this team is going to win. They don't have the playmakers to make these flashy plays. Nelson Aguilar had an amazing catch to end the second quarter, but I wouldn't expect that throughout the year. And so I think what we're seeing with this team running the ball, playing tough defense, really focusing on the fundamentals and not making mistakes, this is going to have to be the Patriots' way this season.
So I want to point out, you did specifically say last Monday, Jonathan, identity. Is this going to be a passing team? Is this going to be a rushing team? So it sounds like you're saying it's going to be a rushing team.
It's going to have to be.
Yeah.
There aren't enough playmakers, I think, as Chris can attest to. I mean, just watching this game yesterday, everything just seemed so difficult early on, like getting these drives, getting these plays together. Just nothing came easy for this team when it came to the passing game. With Mac Jones, we're still trying to see, is he going to make that leap? I don't know if this is the year that we'll see that fully. I don't know if he'll be even given that chance to right now, just how the offense is set up and the coordinator situation. And so I think the identity is tough defense and tough running and just rounding it out.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, one of the kind of common football sayings is it's hard to run when they know you're going to run, right? It's the mark of a good team. If you can effectively run the ball when they know you're trying to run the ball and run down the clock, and that's exactly what the Patriots did to close that game out. So I think that was probably the most encouraging thing coming out of that game. But man, it was ugly. And I think kind of a mixed bag for Mac Jones himself personally. He had some decent throws, some moments that he did shine. But there were a couple points where he did almost throw the game away, basically.
Second and 9, Jones throwing on the move, and he throws it right to the Steelers, but they can't come away with it. Sutton, that was a gift.
So, I mean, that's a missed interception there by the Steelers. That would have been an absolute backbreaker. There are moments in Mac Jones' decision-making that I think were pretty questionable, which is a little bit scary, and I'd love to hear you kind of pick this up, John, because I think when you have a guy like Mac Jones, you know what he is. He's not a pure athlete. He's not going to beat you by being faster or, you know, doesn't have the strongest arm in the league. You need his decision-making to be on point, and I'm not sure we saw the best out of him on that front yesterday.
Yeah, still some question marks with Mac in year two. Obviously, the team hasn't helped him out, given the structure of how the system is and the playmakers or the lag to rub around him. And as you mentioned, without the athleticism, without that extra special it factor that we see from a few elite quarterbacks in this league, he has to be that much better when it comes to the little things, being precise with his passing and making those smart decisions. And also another thing, especially with a young quarterback, you know, you got to imagine, you know, you're feeling pressure. You're feeling like I have to make the big play. I have to make something happen. That could cause him to press even more when he feels like, look, my back's against the wall. I don't have that much help as far as weapons in the offensive game. I have to make something happen. So that has to be a thing going on, especially for a young quarterback, feeling like I have to press I have to make something happen, which can lead to those type of decisions.
So, you know, this is a fascinating, I think, thing, I think, for people who are not deep into football, too, because you've got this one person on the field who is young and new, lots of pressure of sort of new star potential, put in a very difficult situation.
I was just saying, following the greatest to ever do it.
Right, right. Fair enough. Following the greatest and a beloved member of the community here, even now that he's not in the community here and you've got to perform. I do want to point out, Chris, two teams on the field. And I don't want to be the Patriots hater, and I'm not being a Patriots hater, but did we win or did they lose?
Okay, so I mean, a win is a win, like, right? They won the game, and you have to be happy with that because, as John said, football is a short season. Every win counts, you know, way more than any other sport. But really, you know, Bill Belichick talked after week one that everything kind of came down to one or two plays breaking their way. And that's exactly how this game went down, too, except this time those breaks went the Patriots' way. Right before the Damian Harris touchdown you played at the top, there was this moment when the Patriots were punting the ball away to the Steelers.
Jake Bailey is punting it. Olszewski, the return man, wobbler, and he loses it. Olszewski coughs it up at the 20-yard line. The Patriots jump on it.
Huge turnover there. That allowed the Patriots to go in. It was 10-6. They score the touchdown late in the third quarter and really kind of controlled the game from there on out. So that a huge moment. They just got lucky. The ball doinks Olszewski right
Doink.
In the helmet.
Yeah. That's always one of my favorite sports words,
I knew you'd
by
like
way.
That.
Doink. I know I do. Jonathan, I'm going to turn back to you now. So very different scenario coming up next week. Team's home opener. What are we looking for?
Well, if you've never heard of a quarterback by the name of Lamar Jackson from the Baltimore Ravens, you're going to get well acquainted with him next week. And this will be a test.
I feel like you're telling me I should be afraid.
I feel like you should be afraid. I mean, Baltimore's coming off a crazy game yesterday, putting up 38 points. They lost to Miami, which put up 42 points. So you don't want to get into a shootout with a team like the Ravens. I don't think New England is equipped to match that point production. So once again, their identity. Making it ugly, running the ball, playing tough defense. They're going to have to stick to that because if it gets out of hand, it can get ugly real quick.
Totally agree. Huge test for the defense next week.
And last word to you, Chris Sitterick.
Well, that's what I want to see. This team needs to rely on their defense to get it done. Let's see if they can get it done against a high-powered offense, unlike the Steelers. The Steelers stink, I hate to tell you. So we didn't really learn anything on that front this week.
All right, so that is WMUR sports reporter Jonathan Marshall on the line, WBUR's Chris Sitterick just there in Studio 2. Thank you to both of you.
Always a blast. Thanks for having me.
Before we go, on the day of Queen Elizabeth II's funeral, let's take a minute to reflect. Westminster Abbey might feel a long way away. London is, in fact, some 3,000 miles across the Atlantic. But we can still remember her here at home. As you may remember or have heard in the coverage since her passing, Queen Elizabeth actually visited Boston nearly 50 years ago. It was 1976. The United States was celebrating its 200th birthday, and the Queen helped mark the celebration with a visit to the city where it all started.
If Paul Revere, Samuel Adams, and other patriots could have known that one day a British monarch would stand beneath the balcony of the old State House, from which the Declaration of Independence was first read to the people of Boston, and be greeted by the mayor and others in such kind and generous words. Well, I think they would have been extremely surprised. But perhaps they would also have been pleased. Pleased to know that eventually we came together again as free peoples and friends, and defended together the very ideals for which the American Revolution was fought.
Former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, who was serving in his first term at the time, was with the Queen that day. We caught up with him just a few days ago, and we started by asking him to take us back to July 11th, 1976.
Well, it was an extraordinary day, in part because Massachusetts and New England were struggling badly during that period. Our economy was in terrible shape. We had widespread unemployment. People were down. And the Queen showed up on a remarkable day where 250,000 people came down to the Esplanade to see her and to be part of the festivities. And it's not that visit by itself transform things, but it was the start of a transformation.
What kind of transformation?
Boston and Massachusetts began to be proud again, to go to work together, to begin to build a better society, a better place. It wasn't overnight. Obviously, it took a long time, and we're still working on it. But it's hard to describe just how important that was to our morale, our perception of ourselves, and our ability to go to work and transform Massachusetts and New England into something we were proud of. Now, some interesting things happened on that day, which I'll be happy to talk about.
Tell me.
Kitty and I and Kevin and Catherine White, the mayor and his wife, were down there with lots of people early in the morning. The royal yacht had come down from Canada, and when we arrived, it was at the dock, and we all waited expectantly, not having any real sense of what was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, there she was on the top deck, looking down, big crowd, big cheers. But the gangplank that came from the upper deck to the dock was really quite steep. And without any help for anybody else, she stepped out onto that gangplank, which happened to have some carpeting, but apparently was slippery. And she began sliding down the gangplank on short heels. And coming straight at me.
Coming straight at you.
Straight at me. And the one thing we had been told in being briefed about her visit, which was repeated over and over again, was never touch her. Don't take her by the hand. Don't take her by the elbow. Don't seek to guide her. Don't touch her.
Goodness. And now she's barreling at you.
Well, here I am. And she's sliding down the gangplank at me.
Did you break into a sweat?
I'm not sure I broke into a sweat, but I wasn't going to let her fall. Fortunately, she came down the gangplank, sliding on her heels, hit the ground, hit the deck with a bump, but didn't fall, and very politely said, "Good morning." It was quite a welcome and an entry.
It feels iconic, Governor.
I want to tell you. And then we had a wonderful, wonderful day. But I'll never forget her coming down that gangplank and my sitting there saying, "What do you do now, Dukakis?"
You know, we have some pictures on the WBUR website at WBUR.org from the visit. They are compelling, they are striking. One really stuck out to me, Governor. So you've got the troops of the 10th Regiment of Foot, which is a historically recreated infantry unit, portraying the British Army as they were 1775 America. Behind them, you've got 1976 America. You've got a huge group of current-day demonstrators, protesters. They've got signs. They look angry. They're protesting the Queen's visit. The signs say things like, "The Queen's soldiers murder Irish people and England, get out of Ireland now." Do you remember that protest energy, and how do you remember that?
I do indeed, although they were physically somewhat away from where we were. Not a lot, but they weren't, 5 feet or 10 feet or 25 feet from us. And one of their particularly active members was a state representative from Somerville named Marie Howe, who was very, very strongly pro-Irish. And the one thing I remember Elizabeth saying was when they were demonstrating and making some noise, Elizabeth said, "Some people never forget anything," which I thought was a little tough on these folks. But I remember that distinctly.
That's so striking, because I'm sure you know that now in her passing, it has sparked a new conversation, both about the British monarchy and about the imperialist and colonialist history and how to mark her passing, giving all the things that she stood for as a queen. I just would love your reaction to that, your thoughts about that.
Well, I remember the day particularly because it was so transforming in so many ways. It really was. And really did mark a kind of new beginning for Boston. And then, of course, inspired by that, a lot of us got into it and began to go to work and do everything we could to transform this place in a very public way. But it's ironic, isn't it, that it was the Queen of England who had a lot to do with that and helped us in a very real sense to get started on a new path.
It's so ironic, given that there are those in some countries around the world right now who feel the Queen kept them on an old path, stood for an old path. Do you see that kind of power in the British monarchy today in 2022?
No, I don't. And it'll be interesting to see what happens now that she's gone and Charles has taken over. But my sense is that there will be some significant movement, and I suspect members of the Commonwealth that will no longer continue to be part of the Commonwealth and will leave and become independent republics.
Governor, chalk this next question up to I simply can't resist while I have you. So we've been talking about your time with the Queen, your first term as governor, 1976, when your first term was 74 to 78. You go on to serve again in the 80s. And I'm thinking about the conversations you and I have had in the past about your passion for public transit and your focus on it at the time and now. Yeah, there we go. So let's go back to 76. If I told you that 1976, Michael Dukakis, where we are with the T right now here in Massachusetts, would you have believed it?
No. We worked, and I mean all of us worked very hard to get the T back on track, if you'll pardon the pun, and to give this city and this state a first-class public transportation system. And I think by the time I left office, that's exactly what we had. And to see what's been going on lately. I wasn't on that Green Line car that burst into flames the other day, but I mean, this is just appalling. And my hope is that a new governor will go to work on this just as hard as she possibly can and give us the kind of public transportation system that we need and deserve and will support. I mean, this is a transit town.
And do you believe all the raw materials are there to do it, Governor Dukakis? The money, the will, the technical capacity, the human resources, do we have all the building blocks?
Sure, certainly do. I have no doubt about it. And a public that will support it. I mean, it's not that we don't have money these days, but we have 650 defective bridges in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Can you believe that? It's embarrassing to drive around the state. Hold a transit for a second. Just drive around the state and drive along highways that are covered with graffiti and bridges that are rusting. I mean, this is... What's the matter with us?
How did we get here?
Well, I'll leave that to others. But what I'm particularly interested in, and I hope people of the state are interested in, is a major effort to give us a first-class public transportation system.
That was former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis sharing some of his memories from Queen Elizabeth's trip to Boston back in July of 1976. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.